session number 22905, rule 6.
So Dick, you were talking about the celebrations that you were having after the end of the war.
Yep, yeah.
Continue on.
Well, that continued at the camp for a while, but I had bad ears. At the time I had boils in both my ears and had to go straight to hospital. For the first few days I could get all the rice I wanted to put rice pads on my ears for warmth, which you couldn't do before. That went on for a couple of days, and then I went straight into town to the hospital, the Chulalongkorn Hospital in Bangkok. And I was there for, the best part of a week, I suppose, roughly. Woke up one morning, one of those little Japs scrubbing the floor at the foot of my bed, made me very happy. And from there, I went out a couple of times on leave, snuck out while they weren't looking. And I was going downtown one day, and I'd learnt one word of Siamese, and that was Sawadee. And it depends on how you say it as to what it means. Hello, goodbye, pay respects to a parent or something, you know. Anyway, this young bloke, two of them young blokes come down the road, and I said, so what, you know, half done with half a bottle of grog in me. And this young bloke said to me, how do you do? Frightened the hell out of me. And anyway, young bloke, I've met him since. And he wanted to know all about things, and we made friends, and they'd put a picture show on for the ex-POWs. And it was the saddest thing ever, of course. It was the Sullivans. It was four brothers who got killed during the war, which was a wonderful thing to put on for ex-POWs. But anyhow, we were going on to that, and I asked these two kids, there's another bloke with me, Billy Breed. I told you earlier about Billy Breed having to get the plane home. And I said, well, come to the pictures with us. Well, they hadn't seen a picture show right through the war, anything, so they came along, and of course, soon to go along, there was trouble. The manager was there with all his staff, and he'd lined up to welcome us in, and he tried to stop these two blokes because it was for POWs only. Anyhow, after some friendly arguments and so forth, I got them in. Well, they were thrilled a bit, so the only Asians in the theatre, and after that became friends. And every morning at dawn, they'd be waiting for me with a car to take me around somewhere to meet friends or to go to eat. And all I did was eat and meet friends and drink for about 3 or 4 days. They nearly killed me. With kindness. It was absolutely wonderful. And in the end, I had to get on to our local sergeant, Les Cody, and suggest him got me out of Bangkok before they killed me, you know. And so they did. They got me on a plane through to Singapore. And we were there, I don't know, a few days or more. And as I said a while ago, I thought I told you I didn't about Billy Breed. Anyhow, we were camped outside the jail, and they were going through us and seeing about getting us all ready to go home, and if you had a good enough story, you'd get a plane home, otherwise you'd go by boat. So I went up and saw this sergeant bloke and told him a few stories, look, what I'm not bad at. And he said, all right, you can be on the plane, see? And then I went back and saw my little mate Billy Breed, who's a little pommy bloke that owned a farm down south. He couldn't tell a lie if he wanted to. And I said, go on, Bill, go up and tell him that you want to come with me. And he said, what'll I tell him? So I said, I'll tell you what, go and tell him you've had a news over that a bloke's moved in on your farm with your wife, and if you go and get home quick, you're going to lose your farm. He wasn't even married. Anyway, up went old Bill and told the story, and I was watching from a few yards away. And this sergeant nearly fell off his chair laughing. He just laughed his head off. He said, Bill, you're on. So Bill and I got on the plane together. It took us 5 days to fly home from Singapore. We flew to Manila and to somewhere else, and then both ends of New Guinea and so forth. The pilot who was to bring us home, he was the bloke in charge of the Air Force up in Asia, New Guinea and all that area. And he was getting sent back to the mainland, which is Australia. And he wanted to wait for the new bloke to come up so they'd have a welcome party and a farewell party all in one. But he wasn't allowed to do it. He supposed to go back to Australia. So he flew up to Singapore and he picked up a load of us. And he took 3 or 4 days to get back to Leh, where he would eventually have his farewell party. And that's why it took so long. Then we flew from there into everywhere. Each night we stopped, we went to hospital. And next morning we flew off again. And then we landed in Townsville. And that was our first touch of Australia. I hopped down and kissed the ground, as many did. And then from there we went by train to Brisbane. We had a night in the hospital in Brisbane. Then there I met a little girl I used to know before the war. She married a mate of mine, and she was an ambulance driver. And being half silly, I rushed in, put my arms around her and kissed her. And of course, she was terrified, being only an ordinary corporal, that the officers would have her and so forth. But we'd hardly seen women in the army. We didn't realise that women were in the army. And she was the first. And anyway, they took us in the ambulance to hospital. We stayed overnight. And then next morning, we went down to Brisbane. That was Brisbane. That was Townsville. And then Brisbane. Stayed a night in Brisbane in hospital. The next day, down to, by train, this was, hospital carriages, down to Melbourne. And every station we stopped at, there were hundreds of people there inquiring about any of their relations that were up there, if we knew Bill Smith or anybody else, you know. And the food, there was big Christmas cakes, churns of ice cream. The first time I ever saw daffodils, hundreds of daffodils, they just poked these in us. That we could hardly move in the carriages. We left each station. And we had the hospital carriages, and beside that we were locked off from the rest of the train, and that was for ordinary troops. So mate and I went and worked on the door between the two of us, and so we shoved all this stuff through to the troops. That's when we first realised there were so many women in the army. And we shoved all this stuff through, and they were living on ice cream and fruit cakes and fruit. Well, you had no idea what they'd do. It was absolutely incredible. And then the next day, someone would fill us up again with all the photographs and everything. And I learnt my lesson up in New Guinea. A young bloke came up to me and he said, did you know Nobby Clark up the line? And I said, yes, old Nobby died up in such and such a place. I said he died of cholera. And all of a sudden I said, what do you want to know? He said he was my father. Well, that Lord taught me my lesson. I held my tongue from then on. And unless we're very definite about somebody, we didn't tell anybody anything. And when I got to Sydney, I went out and saw an old aunt of mine. They gave me a car to go out there and stay in the hospital overnight. And then the next night down to Melbourne. And then down to Adelaide. We didn't stay at Adelaide. We were there for an hour or two because my battalion was over there in New Warsaw. Right? Then we came over the Nullarbor by train to Parkston, which is the station just out of Kalgoorlie. And an old uncle of mine met me there, Uncle Dick. And he met me there and took us into town. And I don't know that we did all the pubs, but we tried. And we couldn't buy a drink. We couldn't do a thing. And every pub we left, they put half a dozen bottles of beer in our arms. And, oh, it was incredible. You could never describe the welcome home. I reckon I could write a book on my trip home. And anyhow, when we were getting on the... when we came back, they were poking us into this ambulance, into the hospital carriage. And we were so full, they're falling out the other side. And it was held up late for a while. And that's when I first realised a bloke was calling the roll, and he called for Corporal Ridgewell. I said, Private Ridgewell? He said, no, it's Corporal, yeah. Which I was when I joined the army and was derated when I joined the battalion, you know. And I said, right, from now on, Corporal Ridgewell, which it was. And when I came back, I got paid as a corporal. I acted a few times during the period. Came home, my mum and dad were on waiting on the station for me. A young bloke brought him in by car, and I've still got a wristlet watch. So when I left to go away, my mum and dad bought me a wristlet watch. And during my POW life, I sold it. I had to sell it for food, and I bought about 100 bananas. I mean, with it over a period of time. And when I came home, the first thing my dad said, "Where's your watch?" And I told him. And he took his watch off his wrist and put it on mine right there, and I've still got it. Little old gold watch, and it's in there. He's passed on many years ago.
And, would you like to come back to a place that hadn't been touched by war?
Well, that was up until now, we didn't know. We were living in the sky. We were living in heaven. Everything was wonderful. When we landed in Perth, we were supposed to go straight on to Karrakatta and Hollywood Hospital and so forth. But I pulled out and I shot through with my mum and dad and went home. And the next day I went and reported at Hollywood. And down there, they were absolutely terrific. They just treated us. They couldn't do enough for us. Actually, our blokes almost ran the hospital. They came and went as they liked. Blokes that had big ulcers on their shins, they used to cut the ulcer out and then cross the other leg over it and cut that and make them grow together, then cut the skin off and give them a new shin. Well, they were like that for 3 or 4 months, and so there's no limits. You've opened their little cabinets next to their beds, it was full of grog, and They were free. They just let us do as we liked. They're absolutely wonderful. Nobody did anything disrespectful to anybody. The nurses and the sisters were respected in every way. And as I say, we almost took the hospital over. We went out. We weren't supposed to, but we left and went out, went visiting, came back at night. And you'd hear 3 o'clock in the morning, you'd hear some blokes coming down the passageways to the ward, singing their heads off, full as boots. And all the flowers used to be put out of the wards in the passageways. And the mad buggers would pick up an armful of flowers and bring them out to the sister in the ward. There's only one sister on in the ward all night. And then her battle was getting up to bed. But they always got a bunch of flowers every night. And they finally got them to bed. And we were treated for everything. The hookworm was one of our biggest problems. They couldn't cure. And they used to give us what they called the bomb. And it was some sort of medicine that hit you and you went out to it. And you were crook for a few days, but it didn't cure. We had a cure later. And a lot of blokes had operations on there, you know, for despondency and for not being able to handle things and so forth. We just lived wonderfully in Hollywood. It was terrific. I could go on forever about that. Then we got out, and just after I got out, I was down at a friend's place at Fremantle. And I now got a phone call through to say that my dad was dead, and I rushed home, and he wasn't dead, he was sick, very sick, so we took him into Hollywood Hospital, into Perth Hospital, and he died of a blood clot 2 days later or something, and that was the first of my parents I lost. And our biggest problem was, we were definitely half mad. We didn't know, we couldn't understand cues, people queuing up for anything. We just couldn't understand it. I got in a lot of trouble over it. I remember taking my Alma before we were married into Woolworths one day, and the kid behind the counter was mouthful of chewing gum, chewing away, yeah, what do you want? And I did my lolly with her, and that happened many occasions. We just couldn't handle it. And then they let us free. I don't know if I told you, but there was a doctor, Colin Anderson. He told me years later, we were in the same lodge together, and he told me that before we came home, they didn't know how they were going to handle us. They knew we'd all be mad. So one doctor from each state went to Melbourne. We didn't know about this, but he told me some private years after. Went to Melbourne and had a get-together and decided what to do with us. And their final decision was that there's nothing they could do, just let us be and slowly bring us out of it, which they did and was the most sensible thing and wise. And we slowly came out of it and took responsibilities on, got a job, started working. And, matter of fact, coming back from my father's funeral, the old fellow, old Bob Moore, he said, I was still in the army. He said, what are you going to do? And I said, I could look for a job, I suppose, Mr. Moore. Come and see me in the morning, he said. So I went and saw him, and I started work at Armour and Sons. Started just a scrap piece and so forth. I finished up assembling engines and that sort of thing, and general engineering, you know. And then they started the whaling industry. The Moors, one of the Moor boys, went up north and to Point Clotes and saw the old whaling station that hadn't been opened since, had been closed in 1926. Plenty of whales up the coast because they hadn't been touched all these years. So anyhow, come home, spoke to father, and they decided to rebuild the station and start the whaling, which we did at Point Clotes. And we got ex-Army, ex-Navy boats, fair miles, and got them built up suitable for guns. We got we brought gunners out from Norway, and we used to get to where we finished up with an allocation of 1,000 whales a season, which was only 3 or 4 months. At those times in Shark Bay, you could just spot them out in the bay and say, well, I'll go and get that one. But as it got, we got further into them, we had to go many miles out and tow them in, sometimes towing for 10 or 12 hours to get them in, you know. And then the Commonwealth then started a whaling commission, the whaling commission at Carnarvon. And being a Commonwealth, you know, it didn't seem to work exactly as good. And we bought them out. I remember, I think it was 12,500 or something, or some ridiculous amount of money. We bought the thing out from the government. So we moved from Point Clotes down to Carnarvon, with their 500 and our 500, so we'd catch 1,000. But they had big steam chasers. They'd gone to our little diesel things. So we finished up with a big steam whale chasers, the ones they used down the south and Antarctic and so forth. And we used to get 1,000 whales. We went on that for years, several years, and then finally one year we couldn't catch them. They weren't available. And well, in the meantime, Albany started whaling. They started whaling down there. One year they didn't catch their lot, so we took on theirs, over our 1,000. We got another 200 of theirs, so that was the biggest catch of all time. They were worth about 1,000 pounds a whale those days. And if you get 1,000 of them, it was good money. Anyhow, they built the factory up. We doubled the factory with the stuff from Carnarvon and the most modern one at Shark Bay, Carnarvon, that we took over.
I wanted to speak to you in relation to, you know, you seem to have moved into civilian life pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
But how difficult was it for you to really sort of get rid of the memories that you had of the Burma?
Well, never ever got rid of the memories. Never ever, not to this day. Not even to today. I've just been to Singapore and I've finished up in tears there. But you don't get rid of the memories, they're there, and we only discuss them with our own friends. We never discuss them with much. Well, of late we've been discussing with our wives, but normally not. But we just had to live the life. And when I started work, I was so thrilled to have a job that I didn't have to do, that I remember a couple of folks come to me from the union and told me to either cut it out. I'd either have to ease up or they'd. Of course, because I was working too much, too often, too hard. So I learnt, and then when they took on the whaling industry, I was driving a truck down to and from the boats with stuff and so forth, and then I finished up. I was looking after the repairs and maintenance and stuff on the boats. And,
do you think that you sort of threw yourself into work to try and forget your?
Well, work helped. Work helped terribly. We still couldn't stop. Flip your fifth, you know, pinching things. We're still, because so feared up your life, you saw anything, you grabbed it, you know, as long as it wasn't your mate. We still knocked little things off here and everywhere, but I think we just grew into it. I would say the blokes who've got a good wife, are the blokes that are still alive today, they were worth £1 million. And a lot of them.
People talk of coming back to a society that wasn't interested, didn't really understand what you'd gone through, and that caused problems for the chaps that came back. Were you?
No, not really. The Vietnamese blokes had that trouble. We didn't really have that trouble. We didn't talk about it. We just went into our shells. We got together. As soon as we came home, every morning we used to be in town waiting for the pub to open 11 o'clock with our mates. As long as we had the blokes that we were with, we were with them all the time. And then slowly we got married off, and as I say, those blokes had a good wife. Well, they lived. But the blokes who didn't get married, they're all dead now, the whole lot of them. And,
what was your experience in Singapore like? You just went recently. Tell us a little bit about what went on.
Oh, well, it was a wonderful experience. The Veteran Affairs took one or two from each effort. See, from West Australia, there was me and a widow. And we flew to Sydney, joined them there, and then flew to Singapore. And we were, well, king of the castle. They first class everything. They went back onto old battlefields and old places where we'd been and where we'd had action. And in other trips I've had to Singapore before, we couldn't go near those because they now covered it, but we had the diplomatic service looking after us and all that.
What was it like to return to the places you've been in 1942?
Well, that this time it hit home a bit because we went right back. When the Japs first came across the causeway to Singapore, it was my battalion. I wasn't there, but some of my battalion machine gunners who stopped them the first night, really, really stopped them. And we went back to that position where they first landed. And because of that stopping, when we did become prisoners, we had to go right around. We were the first people that had to go onto Johor to build a shrine for the Japs from where they started off. And then, of course, as I've told you before, we went to all sorts of jobs. But on this occasion, well, it got very, very, very emotional because we went right to it and they... They just spent their time, they'd studied out everything and everybody, and they took us right to the things that we can't do as a civilian, you know, And it was really wonderful, really wonderful. They did a mighty job.
What would you say to those people that weren't there? How would you describe the overall experience?
It's something you can't describe. We've spoken to people and they just don't understand. You pick up a dead mate and carry him home, smothered in maggots or something, or you got the blokes in the cholera camps, just you can see them from the distance and so forth. You can't explain to anybody. People say, oh yes, but they you could never ever explain. We were just animals, and we were beaten by. And there was no punishment other than physical punishment, and we would just have heads down and bum up and do as we're told.
People talk about the mates and the memories that they have of their mates, and I was interested to ask you how you would compare the sort of bonding that goes on between a mate and family. Is there a similarity or is it completely different? If so,
it's completely different, and I always use the expression there was a love. We needed it because we were dependent. Each would depend on the other. You all the time. I know a bloke, when we were in the camp, the bad times, one bloke used to have a couple of 4 gallon tins of boiling water for me when I come home at night, one to drink, one to bathe, whatever. Well, that was worth £1 million, but there's no similarity in your relationships with your home, your friends, brothers and sisters, and see what they're. We still meet. I would still have 3 phone calls a week. If they don't ring me, I ring them. We just ring around, say hello, and if ever anybody's going anywhere of any interest, they'll get in. They still go together to all sorts of things. We're still a unit, but it's different to your family. Different. I've tried sometimes to talk to my son, and he's tried to listen, but you can't. You just can't.
Do you suffer nightmares, or have you in the past?
Many, many. But even now and again, I have a dream. But not much, not much. It's always there.
Are you able to describe what those dreams?
It's only a hash up of things that happened to you during the war. It's not the same thing. It's something similar that's happening, in a dream. But you soon get over it. We've lived it that long now. It's 60 years now, so it doesn't matter, does it?
What of the idea of reconciliation, of the idea of people wanting to say sorry and try and patch things up? Do you think that will ever really happen?
No, not with our blokes. Everybody else will, but our blokes, we can understand, but we can never forgive. You just can't forgive. As I say to you, we can't explain. It's impossible to tell you what they did. You never know. But I've had a couple of odd occasions when I've been to Singapore, when I got myself into trouble for pushing, shoving, and hating them. And I had a bloke in my office when I was working one time, and he was very important to the company, and I did my lolly and with him, and we nearly lost their business over me. But I've got past that now. I can see them, meet them. I don't want to make friends with them, but it doesn't worry me that much.
Would you like to add anything before we finish?
No. No, you're going to finish off, eh?
Would you like to?
No, it's up to you. That's the life. And as I say, I worked in the engineering shop when we started whaling. I went into the whaling industry after the tension of the boats. They sold the industry out to W. Anglis in Fremantle, that or Pommy, what they were, and Anglis and Company, and was run there. And I worked there and hated the job, and I was glad to retire. I retired at 62. I retired early, and I couldn't get out. But at 62, I got out, and I got a small superannuation because I was staying that long. But since I've been retired, I've lived a wonderful life. It's really wonderful. I, I know when I first knocked off, I was looking for jobs. I wanted to start work somewhere and everything else, and my wife threatened me if I did, she'd be able to play. And we've settled down, and we've got enough money to live on. Veteran Affairs looks after us absolutely wonderfully. They really do. Nobody can do more than they do. And we're covered with all of our hospital, with Hollywood Hospital, any illness at all, any time. And we used to travel quite a bit, my wife and I, but unfortunately she's not well enough now, so we're stuck at home. But
people look at the First World War and they say, oh, that was the war to end all wars, and then the Second World War came along. What do you see the Second World War having achieved? What do you think it's achieved by happening?
Well, it's
what's come out of it?
I can't really say, but I know that this country has prospered very, very well since the war. We've done very well, and it's been a wonderful country to live in. And I don't know that the war did any good. Certainly did a lot of bad. It spoiled a lot of lives. When I came home, friends I knew here had been affected in the fact of the Americans being here and our women and that sort of thing. But, no, I think that now I'm as satisfied and as happy as I could be now, I think. I'm settled, I'm prepared to live my life out as a peaceful citizen.
Look, I'd like to thank you very much for being involved, Dick. Good on you.
Okay, mate. That's fair. Okay.
Cheers.
Yeah, I hope that's satisfying.